Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 299, Operation Everything Pumpkin, Monday, September 26th, 2022. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. Each time I record an episode, I post show notes, photographs, and links to things I talk about on my website, yarns@yinhu.com. Today's episode features the following segments: On the Porch, Ever Expanding Skill Set, and Off the Shelf. Hello, everyone, and welcome. I am coming to you from beautiful Delaware Water Gap, Pennsylvania, where it is a sunny, cool, and a little bit breezy early fall morning. I'm so happy to be here with you today. I have an extended weekend for the Rosh Hashanah holiday and thought I would take this time to catch you up on all of my projects and have a chat about what I've been up to. Thank you so much for your comments and your enthusiasm about the best thing you've eaten all summer episode. I hope some of you have tried those delicious sweet corn cookies. I have photocopied the recipe and mailed it to some friends and relatives so they can give it a try. And I had some really cool posts and comments from you regarding the best thing you've eaten all summer. Eat Your Veggies said the best thing she ate all summer was homemade peppermint stick ice cream, which sounds phenomenal. There were also some posts on the website. Sylvia said panzanella was the best thing. She used tomatoes from her garden and a wonderful sourdough bread. And Linda said the best things she's eaten all summer, she couldn't limit it to just one, homemade peach cobbler, fresh tomatoes, and the deconstructed eggplant parm. That was a recipe I had talked about earlier. All made from locally grown farmers market produce. P.S., she says, the eggplant dish freezes well. Good to know. I use this question, what was the best thing you ate all summer, as a conversation starter when I met with my independent study students during the first few days of school. There are 105 of them, and I don't see them regularly. So this question and their responses to it really helped me get to know them a little bit better and start associating a name with a face and personality and interests. Many students had traveled quite widely over the summer, so it was a great entry point to talking about places they had visited and what they had been doing. And I got a lot of, oh, that's a really good question from students, which as an educator, that always makes my heart swell because that means it's a question they haven't been asked a million times already, and they're actually interested in answering it. And a few students actually turned it back on me and asked what was the best thing I had eaten all summer. So it was a good way for me to introduce myself to them a little bit. As you know, eating and food are often the focus of this podcast and some of its segments. I wanted a fresh start this year in a number of ways. I ended the last school year feeling very downtrodden, frazzled, out of energy, just really not putting my best self forward. And so I spent a lot of time at the end of the summer thinking about self-care, habits, and things I could do to really make fall feel special, to keep my energy up, and to be my best self at work and at home with my friends. And so one of the things I decided to do was to hold off until October 1st for anything pumpkin. I'm sure you've noticed how much stores are front-loading the holidays, how, you know, pumpkin spice lattes were available in August, and everything seems to be just on this fast track. I really enjoy fall flavors and pumpkin, and I thought, wouldn't it be special if I just really put the brakes on and wait until October 1 for all of those special treats that I associate with fall? I didn't quite make it. I did make it until fall, though, before I had pumpkin spice cream cheese on a bagel. And now I have been just really enjoying all things pumpkin. Some of my favorites are Pumpking from Southern Tier Brewery. I have on my list to make this fall pumpkin stuffed with everything good, some really nice pumpkin bread with walnuts and raisins. Pumpkin pasta sauce is always really good. And I also found a Trader Joe's vanilla and pumpkin candle that's on my table, along with all of my knitted pumpkins and acorns from last year. And I waited until after the first day of fall to put them all on my table. And I feel like savoring it and sort of waiting until a certain point in order to enjoy them has really made it all that much more special. On the porch are several projects that I'm excited to talk with you about. The first is the outfit that I'm planning for Rhinebeck. And I have made some pretty good strides on both the sweater and the skirt. I am knitting the Ornata blouse designed by Teti Lutzak. And this is a sweater knit top down with a picot neckband. Lots of increases to create a lot of fullness like a blouse. And then there are a couple of options for the waistband. There's a picot bind off and hem, and you could also do a ribbed hem. And then all of the interest is really in the sleeves. So the sleeves are put on holders while you knit the body, which I have done. I have not decided on the hem or the waistband yet. So I've just kept it on my needles and I'm kind of giving that some thought. Then stitches are picked up and a series of increases are made in order to have quite full sleeves with color work all the way down. And the motif is sort of like leaves and berries, a very stylized, ornamented, as the name of the pattern would suggest, design all the way down each sleeve. Early in the summer, I'm not sure if this was July or August, I purchased the pattern, printed it, and looked very carefully at the colorwork charts because I wanted to design a skirt in the Alabama Channon reverse applique style that would be reminiscent or would invoke the same spirit as the motif on the sleeve. I did that. I worked on it quite a bit in the summer. I created a stencil. I cut out the stencil and I used rose gold fabric paint to paint the top layer of my skirt pieces. There are four panels. The top layer is black knit, and then under that is an ivory. And this sweater is knit in a very, very dark brown with a contrast color on the sleeves of an ivory. So far, I've completed about 2.5 repeats of
the color work motif on the first sleeve, and I'm really pleased. The yarn I'm using is Garthenor Organic Lace in the colors Chalkboard and Chalk. It is from the Woolly Thistle, and it is very, very fine. In some places while knitting the body, I have been a little bit alarmed at just how fine it is, and I have done some breaking and doubling up and felting together of the yarn. It's very, very easy to do because of the nature of this Shetland wool, and thickened up the yarn a little bit to avoid thin spots. While doing the color work sleeves, I have not worried so much about this. Overall, the fabric is thicker because I'm using two different strands. But I think the color work is, you know, really coming forward nicely. Of course, I have super high contrast with these colors. And I am eager to see how it looks when I have soaked these fibers and allowed them to dry, because I think they really will plump up and fill in quite a bit. I was a bit concerned about the width of the neckline, and so I ran a very thin elastic thread through the folded picot edge of the neckline, and that seems to be doing nicely in cinching it up so that it hangs like a blouse on the neck, but it's not too gaping. Also, the very lightweight nature of this garment means that it shouldn't really be pulling down too much on the neckline, because it is quite ethereal, actually. Overall, I'm pleased with this because I feel like my yarn choice is living up to the design requirements of Teti Lutsak in creating a garment that is knit, but it really does look like a traditional Ukrainian blouse in its shape and its weight. It's nearing the end of September, and I still have a great deal of work to do on this outfit, but I feel like I'm into all aspects of it enough now that I'm motivated to keep going, and also I have a pretty good feeling about the outcome. One of the reasons my progress on the sweater and skirt has been a little bit slow is that I have been devoting quite a bit of attention to doing some felted landscape work for the En Plein Air show, sponsored by our local museum and gallery. Samuel and I have been members of the Antoine Dutot Museum and Gallery here in Delaware Water Gap, and the biggest, most exciting, well-attended event, the biggest moneymaker for the gallery is undoubtedly the En Plein Air contest and auction. This year we have more than 50 artists participating. There's a $25 registration fee, and if you register by a certain date, you receive a goodie bag with some little treats and also coupons and vouchers for local restaurants and ice cream and things like that. And you can get your canvas, in my case, this is a piece of felt, stamped on a beginning date, and then you need to turn all works in, up to four of them, by an ending date. And in between, you go out into the field, into the national park area here, and the town, really any location within the boundaries that are listed, and create your interpretation of what you see. So I have gone out twice now with my friend Dee. We're excited to be working together because we are both working with textiles. The vast majority of folks who participate in this event are painters of one kind or another, and colloquially, it's known around here as the paint out. But we are working with textiles. I'm working with wool primarily, and Dee is working with mixed media. She is a paper maker. She's also using fabric, embroidery, found bits and pieces of leaves and bark. And we've been having just a lot of fun devoting time and attention to this thing we love to do. We have one more day planned for tomorrow morning to go out to a different location, and then works need to be submitted either Tuesday evening or Wednesday morning. It will be Tuesday evening for me because I'll be at work on Wednesday. And then the show goes up and opens on Friday, the 30th of September. Folks who submit their art can put a price on it. This year, there's also a buy it now feature that you can put a number on. And the show is judged as well as the pieces being auctioned off in a silent auction. And part of the proceeds go to the gallery, and the artist receives the rest of those funds. So it gets a lot of attention, a lot of excitement. And this year, Samuel and I are both participating. Needless to say, that's been taking up quite a bit of my crafting time, available crafting time. So once I complete the works I'm going to put into the show, I think I will do three. I had three pieces of felt stamped, and I have completed two pieces. So I think I will be completing a third tomorrow morning, and hopefully I'll be happy with it. I have a feeling I'm going to put it in the show, even if I'm not completely happy with it, because I think for me, this is about having an exercise of creating work and getting it out there in front of other people. So I'm pretty fearless with it at this point. And once those pieces are in, I really need to double down on my Rhinebeck project. Do some more knitting, do some more stitching, and just really keep it going so that I am not too much down to the wire. Ever-expanding skill set. Part of my self-care for this fall season and my thinking about how to work at capacity and reduce stress and anxiety is to do some batch cooking and to plan ahead a little more carefully about weeknight meals so that I'm not rushing around and we still have really healthy, delicious food to eat. So I've devoted a few sessions to doing some batch cooking and having food in the refrigerator for the week, as well as freezing portions. I find recipes involving ground turkey are my go-to for this kind of thing. And the three main things that I make to store in the fridge and freeze are turkey meatballs, turkey chili with lots of vegetables also in it, and turkey meatloaf. These are easy for me to whip up. It's just as simple to create three portions as it is to create one, pretty much. They freeze well, store well, and they also like resuscitate well. Some things when you pull them out of the freezer are rather sad, and that's unappetizing, but these recipes tend to do pretty well. I also pulled out a whole bunch of stored up mushrooms and stored up vegetable scraps and made some really lovely stock for soup. I used some of it and froze some of it. So that's been going quite well, and it really has been a gift that I give myself for later in the week, later in the month. I discovered that it also frees up time if the preparation of dinner is really very simple. It frees up time for us to make a dessert in the kitchen instead of spending a lot of time on dinner. Samuel's very into this as he loves dessert, and we returned to a recipe that we had been making last winter. It's from a baking book called Better Baking that was given to us as a gift. And Better Baking explores how to make desserts and sweets and things with more wholesome ingredients, less sugar, a wider range of kind of fruits and vegetables and products, and make more nutritious, healthier things that are still delicious and fun to eat. These recipes are good ideas, but I often find myself kind of riffing on them or trying to improve or expand upon them. And the one I'm going to tell you about is certainly in that category. It's Fig Financiers. I had never heard of a financier as a dessert and did a little research in preparation for this episode. This is a dessert that originated in France, probably with an order of nuns who started making these around the 17th century, like the early 1600s. And they were called financiers most likely because they were made in a small rectangular loaf pan, and the resulting pastry looked like a bar of gold. These small rectangular loaf pans are a very specific thing. I do not have them in my kitchen. So I've been using silicone muffin cups to make these. Some traditional ingredients for a financier are almond flour, melted butter, egg whites, and powdered sugar to keep everything light. The recipe in Better Baking takes a turn and uses tahini in the batter, and I have taken a turn from tahini to sunflower seed butter. Here's what you do. You sift together 1 cup of almond flour, 1/4 cup of granulated sugar, and 1/4 cup of powdered sugar, and a pinch of salt. You have that in a bowl and you set it aside. In another bowl, you place 1/4 cup of sunflower seed butter and 3 tablespoons of melted butter. You stir that together to cool the melted butter and to get a nice smooth consistency with the sunflower butter. And then you add 1/2 teaspoon of almond extract. Then in a separate bowl, I beat 2 egg whites until they are really nice and stiff and frothy. I will sometimes put a 1/4 teaspoon to 1/2 teaspoon of cream of tartar in them to really keep that loft going. And while I whip those egg whites, I will take the step of putting the butter and the tahini in the fridge just to bring down the temperature a little bit more. So then after the egg whites are in nice stiff peaks and your butter and sunflower butter mixture has cooled, then you pull that out of the refrigerator and you first stir the butters into your flour and sugar mixture. It will be really lumpy and unappealing, and you'll think, oh no, it's all going wrong. Don't worry about it. Just get it incorporated as best as you can. And then fold in the egg whites and just keep folding and stirring until your batter does have a nice smooth consistency. Then I have a cookie sheet with my silicone cupcake molds. This makes about 9 or 10 nicely sized cupcakes. So I put a nice big dollop of batter into each one of those molds. And then I take quartered fig pieces and I arrange them on the top of the batter. You could do a whole half of a fig. I kind of like quartered pieces because it allows you to kind of like take a bite of the cake and get cake as well as a piece of fig. So I like it in smaller pieces, but you could do as you please. And those go into a 350 degree oven for 18 to 22 minutes. The result is a really light and moist cake. It's not too sweet, and it sort of has this like lovely richness to it because of the almond flour and the sunflower seed butter. They're completely delightful. And because you don't need any specialized equipment, like you don't have to get out your mixer, you don't even need to cut in butter, everything is like really, really simple and easy. They're quick and reasonable to make even on a weeknight. And they store quite well in a sealed container. I don't refrigerate them, but they store pretty well for a couple days in a sealed container. If you'd like to give these a try, you can follow the recipe that I will include in the show notes for this episode. Off the shelf. I'd like to share with you today a poem by the poet Jane Hirschfield. She is a poet who I've been reading and hearing because she's read many times at the Geraldine R. Dodge Poetry Festival. I've been familiar with her for quite a while. On Poetry Foundation website, there's a very lengthy write-up saying that her poems often hinge on a turning point or a moment of insight. I really like that about her work. At the conclusion of this write-up about her, it says, in recent decades, Hirschfield has become increasingly known as a poet working at the intersection of poetry, the sciences, and the crisis of the biosphere. She once told the publication Contemporary Authors, poetry for me is an instrument of investigation and a mode of perception, a way of knowing and feeling both self and world. I am interested in poems that find a clarity without simplicity, in a way of thinking and speaking that does not exclude complexity, but also does not obscure. So here is The Problem by Jane Hirschfield. You are trying to solve a problem. You're almost certainly halfway done, maybe more. You take some salt, some alum, and put it into the problem. Its color goes from yellow to royal blue. You tie a knot of royal blue into the problem, as into a Peruvian quipu of colored string. You enter the problem's bodegas, its flea markets, souks, amid the alleys of sponges and sweets, of jewelry, spices, and hair combs. You ponder which stall, which pumpkin or perfume is yours. You go inside the problem's piano. You choose three keys. One surely must open the door of the problem. If only you knew, only this, is the quandary edible or medical, a problem of reason or grief. It is looking back at you now with the quizzical eyes of a young, bright dog. Her whole body pitched for the fetch. The dog wants to please. If only she could ascertain which direction, what object, which scent of riddle, and if the problem is round or elliptical in its orbit, and if it is measured in foot pounds, memory, or meat.